because they're going to try and bring the water down. They're going to go up there, they're going to see the land is, in quotes, empty because they're not using it. They're, you know, underselling the corn and so on and so forth. And then they're going to say, okay, you guys, the state is now in there. The state was not in there. There were autonomous villages. This has all happened in 40, 50 years. Very fast. And it's happening worldwide. I just happen to see this little slice. These are basic things. Something we've, the initial speaker said it very well this morning. We have to get our mind off of the immediate and look at these long term. If I weren't an anthropologist, I'd be a historian. There's no insight that comes. If I show the day after Trinity, I was saying about the bomb, the making of the bomb, to my class, and they never heard of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. These are Berkeley students. It's just, you know, blanked out. There are all these things that are totally blanked out. Just like nobody knows who Abraham Lincoln and Washington, because we don't celebrate their birthday by their name anymore. We just have President's birthday. So history is very important to having people understand. And there's a very interesting book called Worked Over, Corporate Destruction of an American Community, written by an anthropologist named Dukas, Cornell University Press. And she does 100 years of what happened in northern New York State, from the mill towns that were run by regional capitalists. Very interesting. And then the big trusts came in, got rid of the regional capitalism, then it was sort of capitalism at a distance, the place was run down, and so on and so forth. So it's an amazing story. The only story I've ever read that really explains the difference between regional capitalism, corporate capitalism, which didn't happen without lawyers, and the result. I often say when I'm abroad and people complain about the United States, this and that, I said, you know, the one thing you should remember is the government is different than the people, because they've done everything to the American people almost that they've done elsewhere. There were more atom bombs that were tested in the United States than anywhere in the world. If you want to see the consequence of that debacle, you should look at the nuclear legacies all up and down the West Coast, from Hanover all the way down to Southwest. Read the book, The Tainted Desert. It's astonishing. So there's something about self-preservation that we're losing or we've lost. Just self-preservation. Some sense of survival of, you know, organ survival, if nothing else. We're buying and selling body parts worldwide. Companies are doing that too. You know, we're all complicit in this, because that's what schools should do. This self-esteem stuff, I'm not much one on, I have to say, Meg. It was invented as a controlling process. So I'll tell you an example. A woman from Lebanon who brought her children to the United States because she didn't want them to be killed by Israeli bombs, was at a dinner party, and she said to me, Laura, her kids were at school now, she said, what is this thing called self-esteem? We don't have that problem in Lebanon. 10 years later, they had the problem. It came in with cosmetic surgery. So it's now in China. They've got problems with self-esteem in China. I mean, come on. So these are controlling processes that get managed through. It was invented in California, self-esteem.
What do you think of the concept of citizen's arrest?
I think it's a great concept. Should be more often used. They did try to arrest, wasn't it Cheney that tried Montbillon in England, tried to arrest Cheney?
I was listening to Robert Fisk recently talking about his opinion after having been in Afghanistan for so long of, you know, why we should basically give up and leave it alone, because they're not us and we're not them, and, you know, it's a completely different system. And yet the justification that you hear for that sort of thing over and over again is, as you stated, we need to bring them democracy and the rule of law. How do you combat that argument sort of with more of what he's saying is they're not us and we're not them and we need to just...
It's not our business. It's just imperialism. And besides, go back to what my father said. Let's be one. And then the world will want to, if it really works, they might want to be like that too. but it doesn't work for everybody anyway.
Right, but nobody, no one seems convinced of that. I mean, if you went around the general public here.
A bunch of missionaries. Okay. I mean, it's really, you know what this comes from? European, Euro-American exceptionalism. We really think we're special. And we have a special something to give the world. You know, Woodrow Wilson addressed in 19 whatever, as president, he addressed the salesmen's meeting of, the national meeting of salesmen. And he said, go thou forth and sell your goods. And along with your goods will be American concepts of freedom and democracy. I mean, come on. And we did it to Europe first. The whole notion of consumerism a la American style and so on and so on.
Well, Andrew Bacevich's book on that is
But it's not just Americans that feel exceptional, by the way. Most, that's the important thing to see. It's not just Euro-Americans. I'll tell you, if the Chinese take over the world, they will be the exceptionalists as well. It comes with empire. But the thing that we're trying to say in the Plunder book is that what we did was, we weren't smarter than anybody. We just knew how to plunder better. We took over a whole new world, right? And then we said, we're smarter than you are. And you lack this, and you lack that. The lack, we talk about the theory of lack in this. Everybody lacks, and we have what they lack. We can give you computers. We can give you, you know, whatever you lack, we can give you. Well, what if they turned that around and said, you know, we think you lack. You lack human rights. You lack democracy. Yeah.
Thank you for coming. I just had a question about, follow on. Why do you think that the American government acts as the world police in terms of, and then I wanted to hear a little bit about your perspective on the Middle East in general and how, why do we think, I mean, not that I support the way that they do things either, but why do you think our foreign policies go the way that they are?
Well, in a word, it has to do with empire and imperialism. So, I mean, our Middle East policy has been really screwed up by the whole Israeli issue and the backing in Israel. Einstein warned us of this. Einstein supported a homeland for Jews, but he didn't support a state because he knew where it was going to go. And there's a very interesting letter that Einstein and Hannah Arendt published in the New York Times along with several other distinguished Jewish scholars. 1948, it's really an amazing letter because what they said there basically has come to pass. Now, Anthony Nutting, who was foreign minister of England, I think, during the 67 war, he said something very interesting. It's stuck in my head ever since. He said, Israel is a Western beachhead in the Middle East. And that promoted, made me think that really the people who support the powers that be, the military that supports all of the stuff that's going on in Israel and allows Israel to go into South Lebanon, to Gaza, and so on and so forth. They don't really care about Jews. It's a Western beachhead in the Middle East. If there were no oil in the Middle East, I bet nobody would care about that part of the world, especially. Unless they cared about water, they might care. I mean, resources. There are going to be resource wars. There are resource wars. So the whole, Falk is the person you should look at on this material. He's very good. International lawyer, Princeton.
Laura, thank you very much for your presentation about plunder and tying it in with empire. I just wanted to tie both plunder and empire in with commons.
Thank you.
And to do it by mentioning Mountstuart Elphinstone, a British, Scottish diplomat and imperialist who left Peshawar for an embassy to Kabul in 1811. In his kit, he had a copy of Tacitus, Tacitus, whose German Wars was his reading, as he tried to understand how did the barbarians of the north divide their lands, which were held in common. Mansteward Elphinstone, in arriving in Afghanistan, saw in Afghan land tenure relations, forms of rotation of land, of sharing of water, called the Wesh, which he related directly to the commons that Tacitus had described. And so I put it to us that the war in Afghanistan on behalf of United States imperial interests is a war for the destruction of the commons. And if we think any other way, we are deceiving ourselves. Anyway, I wish to, I just...
Thank you for saying that. I'll just add one thing. The French went into Tunisia. They destroyed the commons of the oasis that had a distribution, a water distribution system going. And then when Tunisia became independent, they continued the French destruction of the oasis, and now there's no oasis economy at all.
Yeah, I just wondered to what extent you think it's a failure on the part of lawyers or advocates in general to characterize the uses of land, of property, of resources that are different than those of the dominant culture, that it's our failure as advocates that is causing problems in that regard.
Well, there's nothing more Eurocentric than the law, is there? So most lawyers don't know anything about law in other societies. But most people in other societies know a lot about our law. So it's kind of a lopsided understanding. And I think it would really help. Comparative law is taught usually a common law, civil law, one day on Islamic law and one day on Chinese law, but very little. So Ugo Mate at the Comparative Law Conference this year turned it around, and he made the theme what the rest think of the West. And he had China law, Afghani, speaking of Afghan law, and Indian, Islam, etc. And the result of that was an audience that was just dead silence. It was so foreign to be hearing at a comparative law conference. It wasn't that they were not appreciative. It was just like, you know, from Mars. And I think we need to know more about the world since we are in the world and have our military bases all over it. So, yes, thank you.
Laura Nader, UC Berkeley anthropologist and co-author of Plunder, When the Rule of Law is Illegal. The talk was given at the Law of the Commons Conference last month at Seattle University, sponsored by the Seattle chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. Helena Norberg Hodge is a leading analyst of the impact of the global economy on cultures and agriculture worldwide, and a pioneer of the localization movement. She's the founder and director of the International Society for Ecology and Culture. Fluent in 7 languages, she's lived in and studied numerous cultures at varying degrees of industrialization. and received the Right Livelihood Award in 1986 in recognition of her work in Ladakh, India. Helena first went to Ladakh in 1975 as part of a film crew. The Indian government had recently made a decision to open up this isolated region high in the Himalayas to development, yet the traditional culture was still very much intact. Before the 1970s, Ladakh had experienced little change from year to year, generation to generation. For two decades, Helena Norberg Hodge documented the changes in a film, Ancient Futures, Learning from Ladakh, released in 1996, which I've adapted for radio and will hear next. Of her experiences in Ladakh, she wrote, "When I first arrived in Leh, the capital of 5,000 inhabitants, cows were the most likely cause of congestion, and the air was crystal clear. Within 5 minutes' walk in any direction from the town center were barley fields, dotted with large farmhouses. For the next 20 years, I watched Leh turn into an urban sprawl. The streets became choked with traffic, and the air tasted of diesel fumes. Housing colonies of soulless cement boxes spread into the dusty desert. The once pristine streams became polluted, the water undrinkable. For the first time, there were homeless people. The increased economic pressures led to unemployment and competition. Within a few years, friction between different communities appeared. All of these things had not existed for the previous 500 years. Here is Ancient Futures, Learning from Ladakh.
Deep in the Himalayas, on the western edge of the Tibetan Plateau, lies Ladakh, one of the highest and driest inhabited regions on Earth. Scorched by the sun in summer, frozen solid for 8 months of winter, this is a place that might seem incapable of sustaining human life. Yet over the centuries, fields have been carved out of the rocks and sand of the desert, enabling the people not only to survive, but to prosper. But the face of Ladakh is changing.
More and more people these days are having trouble getting along. They're splitting up and living separately. Everything is getting so dirty.
Agriculture is dying. Most people are coming out of agriculture.
There's been progress, but people are not as happy as they used to be.
The modernization of Ladakh calls into question a number of widely held assumptions about industrial society. In fact, it challenges us to reassess the whole notion of progress. Helena Norberg Hodge has spent much of the last 18 years in Ladakh.
I know it might sound far-fetched, but I'm convinced that looking at Ladakh can actually help us to better understand what's going on in the West. When I first went to Ladakh, there was no pollution, no crime, and people had lived peacefully side by side for centuries. And there was an incredible joy to life. But now in recent years, I've seen the impact of the modern Western world on the traditional culture. And this ability to contrast the old with the new clarifies a lot of things. It helps to explain the reasons behind many of the problems that we face in the West, the reasons behind environmental breakdown and the breakdown of communities, and more importantly, it helps to show how we might get out of this mess that we've created.
An independent kingdom until the mid-1800s, Ladakh is today part of the Indian state of Jammu and Kashmir. Its cultural heritage is Tibetan, so much so, in fact, that it is still widely known as Little Tibet. While parts of Ladakh are largely Muslim, the predominant religion of Central or Old Ladakh is Tibetan Buddhism. In area, Ladakh is almost the same size as England, but supports a population of only 130,000, the vast majority of whom live as farmers in small villages. Since there are less than 4 inches of rainfall a year, the Ladakhis have to rely instead on glacial meltwater, which is brought to the fields through an elaborate system of channels, often many miles long. Cultural traditions have limited population growth and helped to ensure that the natural carrying capacity of the land is not exceeded. More than 90% of Ladakhi families own their own land, an average of 3 or 4 acres, and a number of animals. Landholdings are neither sold nor divided, but passed on intact from one generation to the next.
With this little one, I've seen 7 generations in this house. Grandparents and grandchildren, everyone lives and works together. We all eat together, sleep together, and work together.
Villages lie between 10 and 14,000 feet. At this altitude, the growing season is extremely short. Nonetheless, local varieties of wheat and barley produce plentiful yields year after year. Each family also keeps a small vegetable garden, and at lower elevations there are orchards of apple and apricot trees. With few exceptions, basic needs are met within the community. Houses are made from the resources of the immediate environment, stone for the foundations and ground floor, and sun-dried bricks made of mud and straw. Dwellings are large and graceful, yet there's no need for architects. Everyone in Ladakh knows how to build a house. Self-reliance is based on skills which are finely tuned to the local environment. During the summer, villagers spend time at the high pastures watching over their animals. At 16,000 feet, conditions are harsh, but these local breeds of sheep and goats are well adapted to the environment. Vegetation here is scarce, so the herds are moved each day to prevent overgrazing. This is an almost timeless life. Work and leisure are one. Over the generations, the Ladakhis have learned to make the most of the resources around them. Almost everything that grows wild is gathered and put to use for fodder, food or medicine, fence making or basket weaving.
People, they don't waste anything in Ladakh, you see. Whatever it may be, you see, it may be wood, it may be even stones, it may be grass, it may be water, it may be anything, you see. They don't waste it, you see. They take care of it, you see. You see, in that way, we could really see, you see, that Ladakh is actually a very economist. They're the real economist, you see. Not the not the modern economics, as you see, increasing in production, go on producing things, destroying all the natural resources. Not like that. See, taking care of the natural resources and how to develop it.
Everyday life in the village is based on a close relationship between people and the earth. This living experience of interconnectedness is reinforced by the teachings of Buddhism. The religion permeates all aspects of life. Almost every village has its own monastery. Most households have a family member at the monastery, and there is constant interaction between villagers and monks. Within each house, there is a private chapel. The landscape is dotted with stupas or chautans. These monuments represent the essence of Buddhist philosophy, the interdependence of everything in the universe. At the top of the stupa, a crescent moon cradles the sun, symbolizing the oneness of all life. Even the sun and moon, which seem so far apart, are inextricably interrelated. Tashi Rapkes is a poet, philosopher, and Ladakh's leading Buddhist scholar.
Interdependence is very important, you see, in the Buddhist philosophy, because, you see, it says that everything depends on every other things. You see, even things come into being through dependence and through relationship. See, the animals are depending on plants, and plants in turn depending on soil, water, air, the basic elements, you see. And human beings depending on animals and plants and other things. So all are interrelated and interconnected.
Agricultural work is founded in cooperation. Labor, animal power, and farm implements are routinely shared.
In that way, the farming is done. And it is done in a very cooperative basis, you see. They will go to the neighboring families, you see, that some people should come to help us. So they will come, you see. And in return, you see, this family who does the job has also, so some of the members of that family have to take part in, you see, in the case of another family. See, no money is paid, you see, no cash or nothing. Only now, you see, food is settled.
The small scale of the economy helps to strengthen community ties. People have the security of knowing that they can depend on one another. The spirit of mutual support is especially evident in the distribution of water. Over the centuries, a system of sharing has been developed, which determines when each household can divert the main channel to its fields. The animals of the entire village are tended by just a few villagers at a time, sharing the work on a rotational basis. Ladakhi families support each other in a more formalized way as well, through an institution called the Paspun. Each family belongs to a group of households that help each other at the time of birth, marriage, and death. Occasions like these bring together large numbers of villagers, and they all have to be provided for. When someone dies, the Paspun takes care of all the necessary arrangements, from washing and wrapping the body to the performance of rituals in the home. Their work helps to lighten the burden on the family and to give people a sense of belonging to something larger than themselves. Even at the time of greatest sorrow, the individual is never alone. While most work within the village is undertaken at family level, some larger projects, like the rebuilding of irrigation canals or major pathways, involve the community as a whole. In communities of this scale, people know that helping others is in their own interest. Village-level decisions are taken by a council made up of representatives of chutso, or groupings of 10 or so households.
If there's a little trouble, we must make sure that it's settled, that we reach a compromise before it gets any worse.
Although most of the formal decisions are taken by men, women in Ladakh enjoy a remarkably high position. Almost all the important decisions affecting people's lives are taken at the household level, where women are at the center.
Women have a lot of power. What they do is valued highly. Without them, nothing happens.
Harvesting involves the whole family. Neighbors and friends also join in as part of a time-tested system of reciprocity. In fact, harvests are often staggered, so that several families, even from different villages, can work together.
Even the small children, they also so go to the field, and old people, you see. Now old people, they will give good advice, you see. They will supervise, you see, how it is going on, and like that, you see.
This is the most critical time of the year, since the crops have to be gathered in quickly before the first snows. Even so, the work goes on at a relaxed pace. Agriculture in Ladakh is based on human and animal power and handmade tools. The most advanced technology is the rantak, a simple water-powered mill for grinding grain. Yet in the 4 months between the spring and autumn frosts, the Ladakhis manage to produce more than enough food for the entire year. In most years, there's even a sizable surplus of grain that can be traded for salt or tea or even jewelry. And there's enough barley to make into gallons of chang, the local beer. Long breaks are part of a typical day in the summer working season. With the harvest over, hardly a week goes by without a party. Singing, dancing, and music that involve the whole community. Weddings last many days, even weeks. Even religious events take on a festive air, particularly the annual Cham dances, which are held at the bigger monasteries. The dancers are all monks. The dances they perform are dramatic enactments of Buddhist philosophy. Life in Ladakh is clearly more than mere subsistence. This is, in fact, a rich culture, one in which people are able to meet not only their material needs, but more importantly, their need to belong, both to their place on the earth and to the community of which they are a part.
It's important not to idealize traditional cultures. In Ladakh, for instance, there was high infant mortality, and it was very cold in the winter, and people certainly weren't as comfortable as we are in the West today. But if you look at what's important, then the traditional cultures really worked. It was sustainable. People had managed to live in this difficult environment for centuries, and people were really happy.
For the last two decades, Ladakh has been increasingly exposed to modern influences. Roads now link the region to the Indian plains, bringing the Ladakhis not only material goods, but Western notions of progress. In the capital, Leh, a range of consumer goods is now available, and for many Ladakhis, life is becoming less physically demanding. However, modernization is undermining the very foundations of the traditional culture and giving rise to an all-too-familiar pattern of potentially devastating environmental and social problems.
With this phenomena, the whole value system is crumbling. All the values are dwindling, and it has become very difficult for the people to keep to the ancient values.
Leh is now growing exponentially, as the new economy encourages people to leave the land in pursuit of paid employment. Housing colonies sprawl into the desert, unconnected to the resources around them. There are no streams here. Residents have to depend instead on deliveries by government trucks. The physical environment of Leh is deteriorating year by year. The thin air is being choked by the diesel fumes of trucks and buses that now pour into the capital every day. Rubbish of all sorts piles up in the streets and on the open dumps on the edge of town. In the traditional village, rubbish is unknown. Everything comes from the earth and goes back to the earth. Even human waste is composted and used as fertilizer on the fields. In Leh, sanitary facilities are almost non-existent. The few flush systems that exist not only put a strain on scarce water supplies, but tend to be poorly constructed. Leaking septic tanks are becoming a major source of contamination. Water from streams in and around the town is no longer fit to drink.
They used to say, don't throw anything in the water, don't dirty it. Look how good the traditional people were. They wouldn't throw things in the water. It was considered a sin.
Waterborne diseases, including hepatitis, which is almost unknown in the traditional village, are now a serious problem. In the past, Leh was at the hub of a self-reliant economy. Its essential needs were met from relatively nearby.
When I was a child, we never bought flour. We didn't even buy mustard seed oil. We were completely self-sufficient.
Today, the people of Leh are becoming dependent on outside sources, not just for luxuries and consumer goods, but for basic necessities like food, clothing, and energy.
Development in Ladakh, and it's the same everywhere in the world. It's a process of planned change. And what it's done is to systematically dismantle the local economy, local self-reliance, and the first victim is the small farmer, whose entire livelihood is completely undermined.
As a result of heavy subsidies, wheat trucked in from the other side of the Himalayas sells in Ladakh for considerably less than wheat grown 5 minutes' walk away. Local agriculture is made to seem uneconomic. There's little incentive to continue farming.
Who knows what will happen in the future? Now things are changing so much. Will we need farmers or won't we?
In the short term, cheap imported food might appear to be a real benefit. But the result is that the Ladakhis are being increasingly tied to a global economy, putting them at the mercy of market forces far beyond their control. In the traditional economy, a kilo of barley is a kilo of barley. Yields are quite consistent from year to year, so the family's livelihood is secure. People know that they will always be able to provide for themselves. The situation in the money economy of Leh is very different. A kilo of barley might cost 3 rupees 1 year and 6 rupees the next. Moreover, supplies of imported goods are far from reliable. For two-thirds of the year, the passes linking Ladakh with the rest of India are closed by heavy snows. Stockpiles built up over the summer are often depleted before the end of winter. Staple foods and kerosene, which is now widely used for cooking, are both rationed. Competing for scarce resources inevitably leads to friction. What's more, the very bureaucratic distribution system contributes to a new sense of inferiority and inadequacy. In the traditional society, people were largely in charge of their own lives. Nowadays, more and more decisions, even decisions affecting everyday life in the village, are made in distant government offices. As the focus of the economy shifts to Leh, families are splitting into ever smaller nuclear units. There's no room for grandparents in houses like these, either physically or emotionally. In the new money economy, traditions of cooperation have lost their meaning and are fast disappearing.
Dr. Mohammed Dean, a government official.
In the past, we were very much dependent on each other. We really used to have some feeling for each other because we were dependent. I was worried that when I have some problem, my brother would help. And now, when the people have money, even for among ourselves, we don't depend on it, you know. If we need something, we say, go and get from the market.
The whole relationship has become very superficial. If there is some strain, some strain and stress, then this relationship doesn't hold.
Even in the villages, the old system of shared work is breaking down. Mutual support is giving way to more individualized concerns, based largely on money.
Now that everyone's gone off looking for paid jobs, you can't get any help with plowing or harvesting without paying for it.
The health of the land is being threatened by modern methods of agriculture, which are now being widely promoted as part of the package of Western-style development. More than three-quarters of the pesticides used in Ladakh have been banned or severely restricted in the West. Paradoxically, the process of modernization is also robbing the Ladakhis of time.
Traditionally, people in Ladakh had a lot of time for enjoying themselves. They worked at a very relaxed pace, even though the technologies that they had were very slow. What I've seen now is that development is actually speeding life up. Suddenly people have to work at the speed of the available technologies. A friend of mine from a remote village pointed this out very vividly. She said, I just can't understand what's happening. My sister who lives in the capital, she's got all these things that save time. She's got a kerosene stove, she's got a telephone, they have a jeep. And yet when I go to visit them, they barely have time to talk to me.
As traditional patterns of community are eroded, a new sense of divisiveness comes into being. Crime and violence are increasing year by year. So too is ethnic friction.
The relation between Buddhist and Muslim in the past was very good. Say, about 10 years back, we had very good relation. But then I feel personally, in about last 5 years or 6 years back, the relation started deteriorating. Right now, the relation is quite strained and it's quite bad. It's not very likable relation.
The position of women suffers too. Now, typically, the man of the house will go off to work in town, leaving his wife to spend the day at home alone, cut off from the center of the new economy. A household's wealth is no longer measured in terms of its capacity to provide for itself from its own resources, but in its buying power. Today, the gap between rich and poor is growing, and for the first time, some Ladakhis cannot even afford a place to live. Why is it that the Ladakhis allow their way of life to be so degraded? Helena Norberg Hodge believes that it has to do with the psychological pressure to modernize.
In one of my first years in Ladakh, I was in this incredibly beautiful village. All the houses were three stories high and painted white, and I was just amazed. So out of curiosity, I asked a young man from that village to show me the poorest house. And he thought for a bit, and then he said, "We don't have any poor houses." The same person I heard 8 years later saying to a tourist, "Oh, if you could only help us Ladakhis, we're so poor." And what had happened was that in the intervening 8 years, he'd been bombarded with all these one-dimensional images of life in the West. He'd seen people with fast cars, you know, looking as though they never worked, and with lots of money. And suddenly, by comparison, his culture seemed backward and primitive and poor.
Throughout the summer, foreign tourists descend on Leh in their thousands. In their own countries, they may not be especially wealthy, but here they appear to be fabulously rich, spending more in a day than a whole Ladakhi family might in a year. Nor do they seem to have to work for that money. The impression they give is that life in the modern world is clean, easy, and trouble-free. Some of the tourists, in turn, treat the Ladakhis as little more than objects. The overall impact can be a devastating loss of self-esteem. Films, and more recently television, have served to reinforce the notion that West is best by purveying images of glamour, luxury, and endless leisure with machines to take the place of human labor. Moreover, they generally present polarized images of sexual roles. The women tend to be passive and concerned mainly with appearances, while the men are aggressive and macho and glorify violence. These stereotyped images find expression in the new toy shops. Among the most popular items, blonde Barbie dolls and gun-toting Rambos. Young people, and young men in particular, are most strongly affected by these new influences and tend to be dismissive of their own culture.
It's the teenage boys that are the weak link in the culture, and I think this is true around the world. And you can see that the culture that's coming in is actually a teenage boy culture. It has fast things, you know, racing through the countryside on a motorcycle or having guns that go bang. This appeals to teenage boys, but to nobody else.
As a direct result of development, the Ladakhis are losing their old sense of self-confidence, of self-worth. In an attempt to live up to the modern Western image, they are alienating themselves from family and community and becoming increasingly insecure. In the long term, one of the most serious threats to the culture and local economy comes from education. Generally, schools are considered to be among the unqualified benefits of development. But what's happening in Ladakh calls into question what we really mean by education. In the traditional culture, children learn from experience. They learn how to grow food, how to build houses, how to make clothes. And they learn about the values which have supported the Ladakhi way of life over the centuries. By contrast, modern education trains children at best for specialized jobs in urban centers. but these jobs are scarce. Increasingly, education is training people to be unemployed. In Ladakhi schools today, children learn nothing about their own culture or about local resources. Instead, they follow a curriculum based on the Western industrial model. Even the language is foreign.
If a child here is taught, he or she is taught in Urdu, a language totally alien to Ladakhis. I mean, their parents wouldn't speak a word of in the villages. More unbelievable is that after these 8 years, you have to go to English abruptly as a medium of instruction, you know.
School books extol the virtue of Western-style development. This English reader contains an example of a letter which a child in India might write to a pen pal in Japan.
Anants are building a large number of dams so that our farmers can bring many millions of acres of land under cultivation.
The school books teach them, for example, how to make tea. And they can easily produce that back in their answer books. You see, first boil the water, then put the tea leaves and put the milk and things. But they can only write that on paper. They cannot make tea.
We have to think of building up many more industries so that we may be able to produce all the things we need in our country. These industries are changing our way of life.
And then after these, after 2 years of this English, you have to face the main examination, that is the passport to jobs or further studies. And students fail here in their hundreds. About 90%, 95% fail every year.
We have very little land left in our village now. Many families are moving to cities and towns in order to find jobs in factories and industries. More and more people vary. Every year leave their village and flock to the industrial towns.
When they fail, they are really in trouble, you see. They cannot go back to the traditional life and start doing farming and other things because they are so confused, they don't know anything because they have been kept away. And they are rejected by the modern sectors. So they belong to none of these, you see. They are rejected by the modern, they are cut off from the traditional.
Yours sincerely, Ashok.
The modern school system separates children by age and increasingly by ethnicity.
For example, we have got one school, Lambdon School, run by the Buddhists. There's one Islamia public school run by the Muslims. There's a mission school run by the Christians. So this is really taking the different communities' children in different groups. And they never get a chance to intermix. And they get a feeling that, you know, the other sect of people are something which cannot be made friendly.
One of the effects of modern education is so that it makes people very aggressive. And one of the strange things is, you see, that in the newspapers and in the media, you see, people are always using the words to fight. Yeah. We have to fight this and we have to fight that. The fighting is not a good thing, you see. Why you fight, you see? Why isn't there any other way, you see, to solve the problem, you see?
With the children off at school, life on the farm becomes harder for the rest of the family. Especially for women.
I have to give all these animals water, and I have to take them to the grazing lands. Horses, donkeys, goats, cows, and there's only one of us. Everyone is at school. This one's in the 10th grade, another in the 9th, that one in the 8th. Another one is studying to be an engineer, and my husband is a teacher. I'm on my own. This is my only helper. She points to a 5-year-old child.
When viewed from a broad perspective, the impact of development has been profoundly disturbing. Modernization is no doubt bringing some short-term material benefits. But in so doing, it is unraveling the rich fabric of relationships which held Ladakh together over the centuries. It is polluting the environment, breaking down community, and eroding personal identity.
People used to have peace of mind. They were happy and they used to help one another. These days, there are motorbikes and things. There have been all sorts of improvements, but on the inside, I don't see the same kind of happiness.
In one way, in spite of all the material progress, all the inventions, and all the knowledge, if we really look to the human situation, and I think they are more miserable now.
We tend to think of development as something that is just going on in the so-called third world. But actually, from what I've seen, going back and forth between Ladakh and the West over many years, it's clear that it's a process that is going on in the West too. It's just that here we call it progress and treat it like some sort of evolutionary force beyond our control.
The changes brought about by development in the industrialized world have been occurring over a very long period of time, dating back to the Industrial Revolution and beyond. As a result, it's hard to see the connections between the problems we now face and their original root causes. In Ladakh, the changes have been so sudden that the causal connections are much clearer. It's here, then, that Ladakh can perhaps teach us something about ourselves.
I think the most important lesson of Ladakh is that people need to feel connected. They need to have a relationship with the place where they live, with the earth under their feet. And they also need to feel part of a community, to actually form their sense of identity through long-term relationships with other people.
In the old culture, these relationships are made possible by the scale of everyday life. Political and economic units are small enough that people can actually see the impact of their actions on the world around them. What's more, they are able to be directly involved in making decisions that affect their lives. In the traditional village, the individual is part of a web of supportive relationships, from the extended family to groups of neighboring households, to the paspun, to the village. This is human scale. As the scale of life grows, community ties are weakened and competition increases. In the industrialized world, the scale is now so big that within today's anonymous cities and sprawling suburbs, the actions of the individual can easily appear to have no connection whatever with the welfare of the population as a whole. And yet the scale continues to grow.
One thing we should be learning from Ladakh is the value and the importance of the local economy, the local community. But around the world, the trend is in exactly the opposite direction. Everywhere the push is towards larger markets, larger scale, and the globalization or the internationalization of the economy is making it impossible for the small shopkeeper and the small farmer to compete. So just like in Ladakh, where farmers can't compete with subsidized wheat that's been brought in over the Himalayas on roads that are themselves subsidized, in the same way, the small shopkeeper and the small farmer everywhere in the world can't compete with things that have been mass-produced on a large scale.
The example of Ladakh forces us to reassess what we mean by wealth. In the traditional way of life, there are almost no monetary transactions. So conventional economists would rank these people among the poorest of the poor. As a consequence, moving from a house like this to one like this is considered an unequivocal improvement. Someone in this house will be making a cash income, and even if it's only a few dollars a day, that's seen as good for the economy and therefore better than what they had before. Economic accounting in the West is no less absurd. According to the narrow way we measure growth, our national balance sheets are healthier if we buy vegetables, for instance, that have been grown thousands of miles away and trucked across the country, than if we buy them from a nearby farm. All the broader long-term costs, from the subsidizing of transport infrastructures to the impact on the environment, are completely ignored.
One thing that I see very remarkable in Ladakh is that anything they do, they rate it, they weigh it in terms of what it will be for generations, yeah? What it will be for their children and grandchildren. We have a common phrase like, how it will be for our tatu, means how it will be for our precious children.
In Ladakh, the emphasis is on the interconnectedness between everything, including our interdependence with life. The emphasis is that we're part of an interdependent web of relationships.
The Western way of looking at the world is grounded in modern science, which today has come to dominate all other forms of knowledge.
The people want to become specialists, experts, you see, in one subject or another. So in that field, their mind or their brain is quite clear. They're full of light. You see. But then the remaining part of their mind is totally dark. You see.
Science has clearly led to some very impressive technological achievements. But the interaction between technology and one-dimensional economic thinking has produced a range of serious unforeseen consequences, both environmental and social.
I see this distinction between cleverness and wisdom. Cleverness is when you are very sharp in your head, and you can make wonders out of it. But then wisdom is beyond that. This wisdom of seeing what is useful and what is harmful for your future, irrespective of how advantageous it is for you right now, this is a difference, I think, from the rest of the world, and this is something that Ladakh can contribute to others.
As compared to the modern time, you see, the people in the past, they were very happy, you see. They were very close to the reality, you see, the basic truth. See, now people have become very much complicated, so therefore they are not happy, you see. They're getting more money. They're having, you see, all sorts of technologies. In one way, you see, their life has become very comfortable. But comfort and luxuries, these things don't bring happiness.
If Ladakh teaches us anything, the lesson is that we need to move towards a more ecological, community-based way of life. We can't go back to living like the Ladakhis, but we can strive to re-establish our connection with each other and with the earth.
You've been listening to a radio adaptation of the documentary Ancient Futures, Learning from Ladakh, filmed over a 20-year period from 1975 to 1995. You can view the film online. Just Google Learning from Ladakh. Ladakh is spelled L-A-D-A-K-H. I strongly urge you to see the film and the images. The terraced green fields and elegant stone houses, the dignified and beautifully attired people, and the images of what the capitalist model of development wrought. These things radio can't capture. You can download an MP3 of this and all previous episodes of the show at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.